This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5Live.
To find out more about 5Live and its sister service, 5Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live. If you look very closely, Matt,
yes,
at Dr. Kermode, can you notice anything different about him between now and last week?
Is it? Look, have you been in a fight?
Yeah, you see, that's it.
Oh, I say.
what would you say is different about him? Can you describe that?
There is a mark on the bridge of your nose. It's clearly come from somebody, I'm going to guess, wearing a ring, giving you one on the nose.
He's got a bit of form, hasn't he?
What?
He's got a bit of form.
He has a broken nose.
And well, I think broken is overstating the level of injury.
I only said that because you rang me up and said, I've got a broken nose.
No, I said,
that's why.
It's smashed and swollen, but I don't think there's anything of it to break, to be honest.
What happened was he had an encounter with Alistair Campbell.
Really?
Yeah. Alistair Campbell. The Alistair Campbell. Look what happened.
And he punched you on the nose.
No, actually, he walked into a door.
No, what happened was,
The
night before I had to interview Alistair Campbell, I walked, shall we say, briskly and firmly into an automatically opening, glass door, which didn't automatically open anything like as briskly and firmly as I was walking. And I went, boom, and there was this, thing of blood and things. So I went in back, I cleaned myself up, and I came back outside and I cleaned the window because I felt really embarrassed about staining somebody's window. And then the next day I had to interview Alistair Campbell. And I had all this makeup all over my face in order to make it not look. And we fell into conversation about what on earth happened to your nose. And I said, well, what happened to it is I'm going to do the interview like this and I'm going to take it off and I'm going to tell everybody that you lamped
yeah,
me.
Absolutely.
And then he wrote something on his blog saying, in keeping with the BBC policy, Kermode is now telling everyone that I thumped him.
Said it was a good story while it lasted, eh? But actually, we just had to pose with red noses on, it being red noses.
I already had one on.
Which for everyone else is, just a fairly straightforward thing. Uh-huh. Support for good cause for Mark, it was extremely painful.
Oh,
look, he's doing it again.
Hang on.
You don't have to do it again.
It's for charity.
Okay. My favourite backflip arrived during the week. This came on Twitter. You can follow us on Wittertainment should you wish to. And it's a backflip. This is where you have to tell, you're telling a movie plot in reverse in 140 characters
yes.
or less. And it particularly works well. So this is the backflip for Boxing Helena. Okay. And this came from
Julian Sands.
Tiny Pirate. Woman forced to live limbless in a box gets a series of life-enabling operations by a kind doctor. It's the feel-good summer film. There you go.
And also, Jennifer Lynch's career goes from being in the toilet to very promising.
Thanks for all the correspondence. We'll get to as much as possible. We also have a box office top 10. You can get in touch, mail@bbc.co.uk. An awful lot of correspondence about Watchmen as well. By the way, thanks to Hubs on this. This is another Twitter came in during the week, saw a poster for Wanted near London Bridge, and on it someone has scrawled, "Who's driving the boat?"
Oh, fantastic!
How about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's happening. So
very good.
At number 10, we're going to do Marley and Me, Bronson, Hush, Not Quite Hollywood, everything coming up before 1 o'clock in our slightly unusual slot.
We're going to have to take a running leap at this.
We are. At number 10, He's Just Not That Into You Two.
I'm still just not that into you two either, or indeed this film. But, given a choice between seeing this film again and listening to the new album by U2, which I still haven't done.
Well, you need to. I'll get you a copy.
Fine. Okay, I'll settle for that then.
Okay.
Will you give me a copy of it?
Yeah.
Okay. So
you could just listen online on Spotify or something, and then you can make
on
your own.
What?
Oh, never mind. The International's at number 9.
Which, I like Clive Owen enough. It has ideas above its station, but for the first half of it, it's quite a sort of good downbeat, bankers are baddies thriller. And then after the big shootout, it kind of loses its way.
That's a bit lazy, though, isn't it? Bankers are baddies.
Well, I think that in their defence, they probably say that at the point that they were putting it together, because movies take quite a long time to happen, it wasn't quite such an obvious thing. I was watching Question Time last night, and it was at one point...
On the television?
Yeah, I do watch Question Time. And somebody put their hand up and said, I'd just like to say that not all bankers are evil. And there was a huge guffaw of laughter.
What? Hotel for Dogs at 8.
It's a film about a hotel for dogs for kids, and it came out in the week that I was on half term, and I asked my kids...
No, hold on.
I asked my kids if they wanted to see it. I didn't get a resounding enough yes, so I don't know.
The Unborn at 7.
I did, however.
The Unborn.
Yeah. Is that what the trailer does?
I don't know. It should do.
The trailer has got all the good bits in it. The trailer is about 3 minutes long. I mean, when I say good, I mean, obviously, I use the word advisedly. It's basically a...
Well, what other interpretation is there of the word?
No, because good? I don't... They're not good bits, but they are good as in relation to the rest of the... So it's got the bit when she does the spider walkie thing. It's got the bit when you first see the face. It's got... It's a whole bunch of riffs from a whole bunch of horror movies that you've seen before, not done as well as them. And it's quite annoying because what it seems to suggest is that an idea that was ripped off from Omen 4 about fetus papyrus still has legs in 2009.
The Young Victoria is at 6. Now, we've got an email here from June.
Did you do that voice for the Young Victoria?
Oh, I just stuck.
It should be Young Victoria.
Okay. Light and cheesy.
It's not cheesy.
No?
No, I liked it. Were you not listening to my review last week?
No.
No.
Dear Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, says June Morrison, could you please ask the Doctor why he rated Young Victoria as a film suitable for young girls when he was totally dismissive of he's just not that into you two?
Because it's not
which,
good.
Which, although not the best film I'll see this year, is far from the worst. This is a chick flick which will serve as a timely reminder to most women and may even offer advice and insight to young teenagers. Young Victoria was highly watchable, technically superior, but is unlikely to cause any young women to reflect on life and love.
Disagree totally.
An entertaining story, but far removed from the reality of life, well, given that she's queen. I suppose. And so without any parallels for young women.
Disagree entirely, because it is a story about a young woman surrounded by people telling her what to do and refusing to do what they tell her what to do and deciding to follow her own light. It is a film about a young woman who does not make her way in the world by looking like one of those ridiculous MTV stars who now pass for pop stars in the modern age. It is a film which says, you know what? What's in your head is more important than anything else. And it is a film in which the husband plays a secondary role to the wife who is clearly the powerhouse. And it doesn't matter that she's
queen
the queen
and all.
Yeah, no, but it's, you know, you don't. You can see a film about a tractor worker in Minsk and it can still have some parallels with one's life. You don't have to be in that exact same situation.
Okay, you're done now.
Well, you started it.
Confessions of a Shopaholic at 5.
Again, half term, didn't go, not going.
Bolt is at number 4. And just really? just a couple of emails.
3D glasses.
Yeah, don't. Simon and Mark.
Yeah.
Says James, just wanted to clarify some points about 3D costing extra. I work in a cinema. This is last week. Okay. We were talking about how so many cinemas are charging more money to get the 3D glasses, yeah. Which is sort of out of order, given that if you haven't got the glasses, it's
you can't
just
watch
a splurge.
The film. Yeah, no.
You don't pay extra for the glasses, says James, because he works in a cinema. You do pay more because the film costs more to make. The reason it costs more is the huge financial outlay that cinemas have to pay for the equipment, almost $300,000 for a new projector and a new screen just for 3D shows. Any business that buys that type of equipment would pass on the cost to the consumer. It's expensive, but then you make your decisions and you have to live with them.
Can I just say something in response to that?
Rubbish.
Jeffrey Katzenberg has told us that the whole of the industry is going 3D. And it is going to save the industry and make money in the future. Don't give me that. We've got to spend money now. Therefore, you've got to pay for us spending that money.
Also, it's unwatchable. You can't.
No. But also, I'm sorry. It's a long-term investment. Everyone in the Hollywood high-ups, incidentally, I think they're wrong, think the whole industry is going towards 3D. So I'm afraid that transferring to 3D is something that cinemas who want to be in that market have got to do. And don't give me that we've got to pass it on to you nonsense.
Tom Carpenter says...
Not
just
buying it.
Add some fuel here. I can inform you my local multiplex does indeed charge more to watch these 3D films, £1.50 extra. In an attempt to try and be clever, we kept our glasses from a previous showing, hoping to avoid the extra charge, only to be told that the extra money was not for the glasses, but the extra costs that they incur in showing the film. So clearly it's happening everywhere.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I don't buy it. I mean, I'm a great supporter of cinemas, but I don't buy this because this is an industrial change that's happening at the top level, and there is really no excuse for saying that the public have to fund the industry sorting out its interior mechanisms. I mean, I'm sorry, it's just not right.
And everyone involved should be.
No.
If you charge,
I thought you were
going
to say something else.
Thoroughly ashamed of themselves.
Yeah, I've had complaints, incidentally, that apparently I say I'm sorry, but a lot.
You do.
Sorry,
but at 3, Gran Torino.
I mean, Clint Eastwood. He's so effortless that people don't give him awards anymore because they don't think he's trying hard enough.
Slumdog's at 2. Watchmen is at number 1. Just a brief sample of the correspondence.
Tip of the iceberg.
I mean, absolutely. Tons of this stuff, all about Watchmen. This from Mark in Nottingham, 50-metre swimming badge, cycling proficiency test, maker of a rather natty spaghetti bolognese. He'd just like you to know. Dear Doctor in Manhattan, I'm a fan of Watchmen, though not a fanboy, see last week's programme. And The Good Doctor is sadly very correct. Depth was massively important to the original text, justifying many of the decisions made by some of the more dubious characters. Unfortunately, the film lacks this in spades, and anyone without a vested interest, i.e. a fanboy, will be bored and confused, including the final decision, unjustified and wholly out of context. It's kind of like a Crib Notes version, which is pointless.
That's the second person who's now used that phrase, Crib Notes. As I said, Nigel Floyd said it was like Brodie's Notes of 20th Century Culture.
This from Jonathan, Geordie Exile in Nottingham. Dear Teen Wolf and Teen Wolf 2, after hearing The Good Doctor's review of Watchmen, a group of friends and I decided to change our cinema plans. Instead, we went to see the Turkish film called Three Monkeys.
Oh, okay, yeah.
My friend's verdict, 9 more and you'd have a decent film. Charters and Caldecott, says Dean in Canada.
Do you get that?
Yeah.
Because monkeys. Oh, fine. I was just you had a blank look on your face, and I wasn't sure whether you'd managed to get there.
That's standard.
I always Nuri put that Bill on. Chaland.
I went to see Watchmen last night, says Dean, having shelled out at the 11th hour, settled into the only seat left in the packed house. Having heard The Good Doctor's pronouncement on the picture, I was prepared for the long running time. It quickly became apparent, however, that the problem lay not with the film, but rather in the faulty projection of the film, the same one I'm sure that Mark saw. Somehow the slow motion version had been sent into distribution instead of the proper real time version. When seen at normal speed, it's only 90 minutes, the only downside being that the actors sound like Alvin and the Chipmunks. It was rubbish. Cinematically yours, Dean. Not everyone agrees, surprisingly. Joe says, Dear Over and Done.
I think, as in, we're over and done, I suppose.
But over is spelled O-V-E-U-R. Anyway,
O-V-
the performances in this film are outstanding from a fairly unknown bunch who treat Moore's characters like they've known them their whole lives, particularly Patrick Wilson, Billy Crudup and Jackie Earl Haley as Night Owl, Dr. Manhattan and the pitch-perfect husky anti-hero. Is it Rorschach.
Rorschach, as in, Rorschach ink block test.
Other pluses are the fight scenes. The jailbreak spills guts with gusto, lending heavily on the dry humour encapsulated in the comic to take a breather from storyline midway through. Even at over 2 hours, the plot is fitted into such a short time span that even fanboys will wish that they were reading it so they could skip back a couple of pages. Pages and pages of all this. Opinion fairly split.
Is it? Is it a fairly 50-50?
Yeah, well, not that you can prove much from this. David Thatcher in Cambridge. Dear Silk Spectre and Dr. Manhattan, having just recently read Watchmen, I can confirm that Mark wasn't mistaken about the original story. It's much more profound than Snyder's retelling gives it credit for. And there's a large amount of political subtext which has got lost in the transition to the big screen. As most of this is told through book and newspaper excerpts, it's hard to see how Snyder could have gotten it across. That's gotten, it's his word.
Yeah.
Without adding at least another 30 minutes to the film. Perhaps he could have done the source material better justice if he'd told it in a completely different way, or perhaps he should simply have left it alone.
Or, as Gilliam said, he was looking at doing it as a miniseries, and that was. But then he asked Alan Moore, how would you do it? And Alan Moore famously said, I wouldn't do it. Can I just agree with the point about Patrick Wilson? I do think Patrick Wilson's a great actor. I mean, I really like him in... what's it called? The Little Red Riding Hood movie.
Is it Little Red Riding
Hood? No. I can't believe it. But Hard Candy, which is absolutely terrific. I'm describing that as a Little Red Riding Hood movie because she wears the Red Riding Hood, is a sort of fairy tale element of that story.
We'll get through as much of that as it comes in, mail@bbc.co.uk, but it occurs to me in this slightly unusual position.
Yeah.
Good afternoon, if you've just joined, it was doing movie reviews because it's Cheltenham, so we're not on air from 1 o'clock, so we're doing it now.
Shall we start?
What is new?
Marley and Me.
Oh, by the way, just before you do Marley and Me.
Mm-hmm. You've got bored already.
Polly Watt says, were Owen Wilson and Jennifer Aniston cast in this film because they're the actors that most resemble Labradors?
Yeah.
If you could answer that question as we go through it. But also, I just want to point out that wonderful poster for the new Nicolas Cage movie.
Oh, yeah.
Which has the strap line, what happens when all the numbers run out? And it occurred to me during the week, is that the least scary strap line of all time? Because as a number of our wittering correspondents pointed out, well, what happens when the numbers run out? Well, you count back from a higher number, or you just go minus.
Can I just say
it really, really isn't very scary.
There was an even worse strap line, which you probably won't think of. There was a movie that was, I think it's Italian, called Naked Exorcism. Straight to... actually, it did play here theatrically. And then it was re-released on video here as Exorcist 3, although it wasn't Exorcist 3. And the tagline for it was, if you don't believe in evil spirits, you will now.
Doesn't work, does it?
No, it's not even grammatically correct.
No, not scary.
Not scary either.
Anyway, and as a number of people pointed out, Bad Hedgehog says the set of natural numbers is infinite, so Cage really has very little
to worry about.
Let's hope
at all.
The film is better than the
Jaws 4. This time it's personal. That was one of my favourites.
Anyway, so okay. So we're talking Jennifer Aniston.
Jennifer
and we're talking Mr. Wilson.
Owen Wilson and a Labrador. Although at one point he does contemplate having a Labradoodle. Based on a best-selling book inspired by a column, which I'm proud to say I never saw, one of those life columns. People do life columns nowadays, stuff I have been doing in my life written as an entertaining news column. And now all I know about this is what's in the film, okay? Never read the book, never seen the column. So everything I'm going to tell you is the truth only from the film. So obviously clearly fictionalized, but so that's it. That's all I know.
You're not telling us the truth, you're telling us your opinion.
No, I'm telling you what in the factual bits as to what happens in the film. Don't know about the real life thing, okay? Bloke, Owen Wilson, slightly rubbish journalist, married to woman, Jennifer Aniston, brilliant journalist apparently, absolutely up there with, you know, Bernstein and Woodward, hot as anything in the
journalistic. I'm already thinking Meg Ryan as a helicopter pilot. Already.
And no, I've got a degree in nuclear physics. And anyway.
Which one was that?
It's the moment in a science fiction film when the person who's been cast because they look good in latex justifies their existence by telling you they've got a PhD in astro maths. When you go, no, that's not why they cast you in the film. Anyway, the story is they're together, they're a couple. She apparently is becoming broody. So his friend says, hey, you know, the way to head that off is to get a dog because that'll kind of put her off the idea of kids. And if you're a dog, now, what's he say? He says, to get this absolutely right, he says, if you've got a dog, you're a master. If you've got a kid, you're just a dad. Okay?
Is that the strap line?
Well, actually, no. I mean, the strap line is, how far would you go for a friend? Probably that was the strap line for Free Willy. How far would you go for a friend? Here's a clip from Marley and Me in which they meet the dog for the first time.
Can I look?
No, just almost. Okay, ready?
Really?
1, 2, 3, go. Happy birthday.
What? God, they're adorable. Oh, my birthday's not for a month.
Oh, that's okay. They can't leave for 3 weeks anyway.
Come on, we didn't discuss this.
I know, but it was a surprise. You can't.
Hi, guys.
Just rescued the mom last month. Family that gave her up didn't even know she was pregnant.
Well, are you sure we're ready for this?
Well, like I told you, you gotta wait 3 weeks for them to be weaned before you can bring them home.
I'm not even gonna be here.
Why?
I'll be in Gainesville covering that trial.
Oh, that's right. Well, that's okay. It'll give me a chance to bond with them and get a head start on training them, get them squared away before you get home.
That's true. Well, how are we going to pick one?
Girls are 300, boys are 275. Except for that little guy there. Him you could have for 200 even.
This one? You're so sweet. You're like a little clearance puppy. Hello, puppy.
This one likes you. Clearance puppy likes you.
Well, that's your guy.
Oh, I was going to pick you anyway. Don't tell anybody. Don't tell the others.
Is that Alistair Campbell attacking you again?
Can I read you what it says in the press notes? John Grogan's book, Marley and Me, is about, with its universal themes of marriage and family, resonated to millions of readers from all walks of life. People from all over the world wrote me letters about how the book mirrored their lives, says the author. Marley and Me is not a dog story, says Grogan. When I wrote it, I didn't think of it as a dog book, and I still don't. I see it as a growth of a family story with the dog as a catalyst. It's a comedy with a poignant side to it. Most of all, says the director of Devil Wears Prada.
Which voice is this, by the way?
It's all about his life, the roller coaster of life that we all experience. It's about the journey that Marley goes on with the Grogans, says Owen Wilson, who plays John Grogan.
You're gonna read out the whole thing, are
you? Marley reminds them how much fun life can be. Now, there are key words that I hate in press notes: journey, universal themes, life and love, learning about it, you know, these things, right? It's like
you could do a voiceover on the National Geographic channel.
I
it all together.
I hate movies that tell me that they're about these things. Fine. So even before I go in,
you're in a bad mood.
I'm quite cross.
Did you see this before your broken nose?
Yes, I did.
All
it,
right.
It was the end of the day that began with Marley and me and ended with me running straight
day
into this
remember.
Wall.
A red letter day.
It was a red nose day in every sense of the word. The problems are numerous. I mean, Owen Wilson's an interesting guy because he plays that. He's a kind of, you know, blue-eyed, beach blonde kind of character. And in his better work, he parodies that and does satirical stuff about it. But in this, he's just playing the blue-eyed, bleach blonde, you know, character. You know, hey, I'm Owen Wilson. Hey, Jennifer Aniston. Every time I see Jennifer Aniston's face, I just think, why is it not on television? Jennifer Aniston has actually got a face that is the visual definition of television. You put it on a big screen, you go, why is it here? She's not. She's in the wrong place. She shouldn't be there. She should be on television, not here. And in fact, Marley and Me should be, if anywhere, on television as one of those, hey, it's Wednesday afternoon at 3:30. Here's an uplifting movie before you pick the kids up from school about how your dog can change your life. It's a lot of stuff about how marriages can change people's life and how children can change marriages. But a dog is forever. And so they have this irritating life. He has the least convincing, I mean, hit points, he's meant to be a journalist. He has the least convincing journalist job I have ever seen in my life. I've been a journalist for 20 odd years. I have never, never, never gone into any office and had any interaction with anybody vaguely involved in journalism that bears any relation to the fantasy sequence of Owen Wilson going in and getting a job as a reporter on a local paper. And then he gets sent out to do that. But, you know, hey, somebody, suddenly a columnist needs
to do a different voice now.
I can't, because the sound of that movie to me is this sound. It's the sound of being sick in a cup in the back row while the dog chases around all over the park and everyone goes, isn't it cute?
Your
and then Kathleen
turns
up and is crossed with the dog. Right, fine. So now, here's the question, and I've asked this before. Who is this film for? It's like, what's the name of those Japanese toys that it's like a
Tamagotchi.
Is it what it's called? Tamagotchi. It's not a real pet, right? It's a battery thing. But you're meant to look after it, okay?
Yeah.
It's like you haven't got any emotional real life, so here's a plastic thing to look after. Marley and Me is like, you haven't got time for a real dog. You're too busy. You're too busy in your high-flying world with your Jennifer Aniston. You know what? Here's a film that will do the whole... It will do the puppy, and then it will do the dog eating your sofa, and then it will do the dog poopy thing, and then it will do the dog has to go to the vet thing, and then it will do the dog getting a bit older and getting a bit more lame. Then it will do, and in almost pornographic detail, I'm sorry to say this, there is such a thing as sentimentality porn, and you know, I've been accused.
No, there
yes, there is.
No,
there is.
That's a lazy phrase. Do you just mean there are some films that are too sentimental?
No, I don't, because I don't think you can be just too sentimental.
So
I
mean, Love Story.
I love
For
Love
example.
Story. I right. love Love Story.
Well, that's got to fit in your category.
No, I don't think it can, I don't think it does. I think there's a difference between watching what happens in Love Story and watching the final movement, and I use the phrase advisedly again, of Marley and Me. And I've been accused of giving the ending of films away, and I've been accused of giving... You know what? I'm not going to actually say
that's
it out
you
loud.
Do. You could
No, hold on. It's a film about a family that get a dog. Figure out for yourself what happens at the end. And at the end...
He has
we
puppies.
Get,
Or she has puppies. No,
yeah, no, because in the middle, they take the dog to the vet, Simon. And after the dog has been to the vet on that particular journey,
yes.
he can't have puppies.
Why? What happens there?
Because the vet speaks sternly to him about...
And says, here's Alistair Campbell,
that's right,
you can't have puppies
right, you can't have puppies
again.
That you're not going to. So we get the 10 minutes of sentimentality porn at the end, which I found deeply troubled. Deeply, deeply problematic. Because... It's just so rank. I mean, it is really, really rank. So, on the one hand, Owen Wilson, you know, making the money. On the other hand, Jennifer Aniston, watching on television. On the other hand, if you've got a dog, right? If you've got a dog, go home and play with your dog. If you, I've got, you know, I love dogs. I've got dogs. I love dogs. I know that what comes with dogs is good and, you know, and...
Evil?
Good and bad in good as much as your experience of them. The wonderful things about pets is that they teach you about dealing with ongoing life crises and the way in which, you know, everything that is born
no,
dies.
They don't.
No, they do.
How do they do that?
Because,
how do they encourage
because,
you to...
Because A, because they're incredibly intelligent. B, because they're just wonderful to be around. C, because in the sort of span of your life, a dog's lifespan is shorter. So you, there is something about the way in which you experience children growing up around pets are better adjusted because they understand something more about the, you know, the universe. I'm going to start singing The Circle of Life very soon.
You're going to burst into tears in a moment.
Actually, I probably am. But not because of the film, but because I love dogs in real life, right? If you're interested in these things, don't go and see Marley and Me. Marley and Me just does the rank little, you know, oh, cute, 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 poopy, 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 cute, cute, cute. Ah, okay. you know, hey,
what was that bit?
It's the bit at the end. The bit at the end, which is the most unjustified, you know, terminal scene that I have seen in a very long time.
Ooh,
it was yucky and then some. And it was made all the worse by the fact that all the way through it, I had to put up with Owen Wilson and Jennifer Aniston going on a life journey and experiencing things together in a way that made them grow.
Don't do that voice
in a way
again.
They never knew they could be together until Marley showed them that there's more to life than just
Bronson
being really annoying people.
But not as annoying as that voice. Owen, on this
text, I've become possessed by the devil.
Shouldn't it be Marley and I?
It should be nothing. It should be Marley and nobody. I think it is called Marley and Me, though, isn't it?
It is Marley and Me, but that's wrong. Why don't we go around that person
Marley
who...
and... No, you're right. Therefore, not only is it poop, but it's grammatically incorrect poop.
Is there anything else to be said in its favour? You don't even think dog lovers are going to like it.
I'm a dog lover! I had a horrible time!
I'm sorry I mentioned it.
I mean, really, like, what else can I say? I love dogs. I hated Marley and Me. Maybe I just don't like people.
Strap lines. Dear Bo, says John in Hereford, in this house, the worst strap line ever is starring Nicolas Cage. That's the one that puts them off.
No, the worst strap line ever is and Julian Sands.
Just a couple of backflips before we conclude part one. I just like this from Chris. Dear Witter and, if you will, Tainment. Ocean's 11. Backflip. A gang of beautiful crooks get out of prison and put millions of dollars into a Las Vegas casino vault before going back to prison. So can something like Ocean's 11 be an example of a subgenre of backflip, the palindromic backflip, as the story reads the same whichever way you look at it?
Well, there is, of course, a very annoying Todd Solondz film called Palindromes, which I wonder if somebody did a backflip of Palindromes, is it the same film? Is it still as annoying as it was the right way round?
And this came in as a backflip for Finding Nemo. I mean, obviously, inherent in this idea is that we're giving the ending away because it's the entire...
Yeah, I don't even know if I mean Todd. Is it Todd Solondz? I think it probably is.
So Finding Nemo, father loses son in Sydney, embarks on mission to find him, only to have his wife die at the end. I think he was kind of lost some of the joy of Finding Nemo in that. Jim says, dear Jay and Silent Bob, please, would you want to be?
I want to be Silent Bob.
Please, could you thank Mark and the rest of the Dodge Brothers in the very jet-lagged pair from the subways for a brilliant night last night? This is album launch time. See previous. Last Friday at the Borderline, they're one of the best bands I've seen for a very long time.
Oh, that's fantastic.
How about that? Dear Beyonce and Jay-Z, having listened to some of the old podcasts on a long journey the other day, struck me just how many alternative movie titles like Slumdog Squarepants you guys have come up with. Seeing as though the Kermode Awards have already gone, I think Mark should consider an award for the best alternative movie title for next year. As is that movie titles have emerged from the programme.
Yeah.
So for consideration, ones that have
Slumdog Squarepants, used, which is...
Unwanted, Are We Rotting in Hell Yet? I don't remember that
what
one.
What was that?
SpongeBob Millionaire, which we've done. I Am Rubbish. Death Poop. And Burn Before Viewing. This is Ice Jack Kane in Auburn. Are they ones that we've done or ones that he's done?
I recognise some of them, but, you know, it kind of implies... The problem is, you have to understand that we don't prepare this.
No, it just...
I know it's hard to imagine, but this is actually unprepared, and we forget most of it the minute after we've said it.
It's absolutely true. In one ear.
It is, and out the other.
John in Hereford. How come there is such a thing as sentimentality?
Sentimentality.
When you have made clear that there's no such thing as torture porn.
Because I am nothing if not inconsistent.
Exactly.
No, actually, there could be such a thing as torture porn. I just don't think that the films that were being held up at that time as evidence of a torture porn, were actually evidence of it. I think there is, you could probably find an example of it, but I don't think there was a torture porn wave.
Robin Ivybridge says the term for the new Jennifer Aniston movie about dogs, soft paw corn. That's poor.
Very good. Pause for thought.
Indeed. So that's some of the
Rebels
stuff.
Rebels without a pause.
We'll get to more of your correspondence before 1 o'clock, unless the reviews just take up so much time because they're really deeply fascinating.
Should we do
Bronson? Please.
Should we do Bronson?
Please.
Yes.
No more of that irritating voice.
No, okay, I won't do it anymore.
Just
okay. In a world of prisoners.
No.
Okay.
Normal
Bronson.
Voice is fine.
Okay, Bronson, which is, in inverted commas, based on a true story. I want to be very careful about this. Based on a true story of prisoner Michael Gordon Peterson, who has been referred to in the British press as the most violent prisoner in Britain. He changed his name whilst he was inside. I think he came out and started boxing to Charles Bronson, and now prefers to be known as Charles Bronson, named, obviously, after Charles Bronson, he of Death Wish, whose real name, I think... Wasn't he Charles Bukinski? Because I think at the beginning of House of Wax, he's credited as Bukinski, so it would be spelled Buczynski, but I think that's right. So changing it to the name that somebody else changed their name to. Now, there's been a bit of fuss about the film because basically this guy's incredibly violent, and this is a sort of biopic portrait of him. It's about his life, most of which takes place in prison, and most of his time in prison takes place in solitary confinement, because the minute you put him with other people, he kidnaps them and then is incredibly violent. Here is a clip of Tom Hardy as Bronson early on in the film, and we've had to alter this slightly because one of the things that the BBFC say about the film being rated 18 is that it is rated 18 for several uses of very strong language, and when they said several, they meant several.
Right. How else can I explain it? There's nothing wonky about my upbringing. My parents were decent, respectable and upstanding members of society. I went to school. I kept my head down. Sure, like most kids, I got into trouble. I liked it.
Oh, Michael!
Mrs. Peterson, I really must talk to you about Michael. It's been
absolutely... But it wasn't bad. Wasn't bad, bad.
But as far as the rest of the movie turns out, he was bad.
Bad, bad, bad.
Now, a couple of interesting things. Reported on the BBC News service on the 10th of March, where are we now? The 12th, a couple of days ago. Prison officers want an inquiry after a recording of Charles Bronson's voice was played at the premiere of a movie about the long-serving inmate's life. The armed robber and hostage taker 56 made the recording at High Security Wakefield Prison in West Yorkshire. And he said, see you at the Oscars. The Prison Officers Association said the recording undermined prison security and the government had taken steps to prevent a repeat. They've also said that they've condemned the movie starring Tom Hardy in the title role for glorifying violence. Now, the director, spelt Nick Wingding Refn, but I believe pronounced Nick Whedon Refn, who I think is the son of Andus Refn, the editor. You, of course, will know him from directing Fear X and Pusher.
I was just going to wonder, is it the same guy?
Says,
that's extraordinary.
Not being British, I wanted to make the film about the concept of Charles Bronson, in inverted commas, rather than Michael Peterson, his real name. I personally can't judge him, as I didn't have any preconceptions or knowledge about his tabloid exploits to even comment on that. The more the movie became about the concept of somebody becoming another person, an alter ego becoming Charles Bronson, which I thought was very intriguing. So we have two different things going on. On the one hand, you have a fuss bring in the press about the real character whose real name, Michael Gordon Peterson, changed to Charles Bronson, and things that have happened in relation to recordings of his voice being played at the premiere. On the other hand, you have the movie, which the director tells us is about the constructed character, the artificial Charles Bronson. I think we have to separate these two things to begin with. Many comparisons have been made to Clockwork Orange, as I think you could hear even from that clip, the kind of the use of that sort of classical music with the extreme youthful violence. And I think if you could see a clip of it, you'd see the way in which some of the camera moves are done, which are very stately and are very Kubrickian. A closer comparison would probably be made with Chopper, the film which was about the Antipodean inmate who actually was very much like this, except that he was much more loquacious. I mean, Chopper himself was somebody who, talked and wrote about himself and kind of turned himself into a popular hero, despite the fact he was an incredibly violent man. He once described himself as just an ordinary bloke who liked a bit of torture. And he didn't say whether he liked a bit of torture porn, but he liked a bit of torture. So there are comparisons between Chopper and Bronson, the difference being that Bronson is largely inarticulate, and the film is much more visual rather than a story told through words. What you get is a portrait that is very deliberately artificial. It has theatricality and artifice. It has sections in which Tom Hardy, who is brilliant. I mean, Tom Hardy's performance in the film is really, really good. The film won an award at the Sundance Film Festival, and Tom Hardy, it is an absolutely mesmerising performance. I think the last time I saw him was in a Guy Ritchie movie, and this is a, total leap on from that. So great central performance. Visually very interesting, because Nick Reden-Reffin does have a very, very good visual sense. His colour scheme's very bold, lots of reds, lots of sort of dark browns, very, very, bold to look at, very visually exciting. And oddly, for a good section of the movie, walks exactly that kind of Clockwork Orangey line between horror and humour. So it's done in a very theatrical way, and it's done in a way which is very engrossing and very entertaining, occasionally laugh out loud, funny, quite often quite nasty, and very physical. It's all to do with his physicality. It's all to do with him as a, as a deranged character, but crucially, an artificial construct. And I think that in judging the film, people have struggled between saying, they don't want to say, I'm approving of the character who calls himself Bronson, but that wasn't his real name. But they want to appreciate the fact that they like the film, but they're kind of caught on the horns of a dilemma. So I just want to separate those two things off and say the film, which is not a film about a real-life character, although it is inspired by a real-life character, but it's inspired by a real-life character who invented a fictional alter ego for themselves, which was entirely violent and aggressive. I think the film itself is impressive, and I enjoyed watching it. I understand that that is separate to the real character. Now, here's the funny, the strange payoff. At the end of the film, there's a thing which says the real character is still not up for parole, and he doesn't have any kind of parole date. And I thought at the end of the film, well, I'm really glad about that, because I've just spent 90 minutes in his company, and he's a psychopath. At the end of the BBC news story, that's the way it comes across in the film, fictional character about a fictional character based on a real character. At the end of the BBC news story, it says that there is now a move from the real character's family to get him rehabilitated and paroled, and they are all saying that actually what they want is his mother said he's very different now, he's not a danger to anybody, he's mellowed right down. Okay, well, again, I don't know anything about the real character. Believe me, if he's anything like the character on screen, he would have had to mellow right down an awfully long way, like a really, like probably down to Australia, where he could probably meet Chopper and they could swap stories. That's how far down he would have to mellow. But separating the film from that person, the film itself was visually interesting and exciting, and Tom Hardy's performance is really something.
Rob in Edinburgh.
Was I clear?
About what?
Was I clear about the way, about the disturbance? I want to be absolutely clear.
No,
about
I think it. You need to go through it, run through all the details
okay,
just one more time.
I was
time.
Clear, good.
Just on Marley and Me, the bad grammar. Mm. Rob in Edinburgh, without context, you can't judge whether it's grammatically incorrect or not, which is true, because you could say that was really tough for Marley and Me, in which case the Me would be appropriate.
Yes, that's right. But it's
but you don't know.
You can tell whether it's correct if you put am after it, isn't it? Because
anyway, Frank says, "Dear Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, no, don't give out the wrong grammatical advice. It's Marley and Me, assuming the title is an object. Otherwise, if it's Marley and I, it's an unfinished sentence and incorrect."
Okay, fine. So grammatically correct, but still poop.
Yes, I don't think I don't think anyone's not going to go and see it based on whether the title is grammatically correct or not.
No, but do you think that people are now going to go and see it because it is grammatically correct? I mean, it's medically correct. I mean, it's correct in a lot of other ways.
But overwhelmingly not, okay, I would say. I think we should,
Hush.
At this point... Well,
What? No, I was going to review Hush.
Oh, I see. I thought you were telling me. Jason Isaacs.
Oh, yes.
What would you like to say to Jason Isaacs?
Hello to Jason Isaacs.
What would you like to say to David Morris?
Hello to David Morrissey.
Stephen Fry.
Hello to Stephen Fry.
Fairports.
Hello to all of Fairports. And thank you for coming to the game. The Subways, and particularly to Charlotte, because
Focus.
We have to say hello to Focus. Hello to the Reformed Concert Angels.
And the Electric Light Orchestra.
And the Electric Light Orchestra. All and any members of them. Are we including Roy Thingy Wizard?
Roy Wood.
Roy Wood.
Why would he?
Well, he was in the Electric Light Orchestra.
Yeah, he kind of started it.
Yeah, so well, are we including him?
No,
because actually, we always think of Jeff Lynne, don't you?
Yes, I think it's post-Roy Wood Electric
post, okay,
Light
fine.
Orchestra.
We're very specific.
This is
hello to the Electric Light Orchestra, but not Roy Wood.
Specifically we're not going to say
not
hello
Roy
to
Wood. Okay.
Unless he can make a very good case to the contrary.
Okay.
May at bbc.co.uk. What else is new?
Hush, debut feature by Mark Tondorai, who you and I...
Mark Tondorai?
Exactly. Referred to for...
Formerly part-time Radio 1 presenter for about 5 minutes.
No, he was longer than that.
I think
that he was the youngest DJ at Radio 1. He certainly was when I was there. And I think, wasn't it, it was a record... I think there was something...
He was like 13 or something, wasn't he?
Yes, incredibly young. And so he was at Radio 1 when I was there and when you were there. And then he disappeared off the radar. And I didn't see him for ages and ages. And then I bumped into him in the Cornwall Film Festival, and he said he'd made a film.
And he's now 15.
Yes, that's right. And he said he'd made a movie, and it was a horror film. And it always worries me when I meet people who I know, because I like him very much. I like his, he's a very, very nice guy. But he said he'd made a horror film, and I kind of didn't see it. Anyway, so the story is, very, very simple story. A young man and a young woman are driving up the M1 en route to the north, and they are going somewhere, but en route, the man is stopping at the service stations to change the posters in the service station, because that's his job. He is the fly poster changer, which I believe is a job that Mark Tondorai has first-hand experience of. It's a rainy night.
The Radio 1 job didn't do very well then after that?
No, I think he did it as a complete life change. I mean, it was a weird thing. I couldn't figure out how this story all mattered together. He started to explain to me. Very briefly.
Okay.
Anyway, so during the journey, the man thinks he sees a truck overtaking with a woman in the back of the truck in distress. They then pull into a garage, and his girlfriend, he has a row with her, but then she disappears, and nobody believes him, and he thinks that she has been taken off in the truck. Here's a clip.
She's been taken by someone in a truck, and I think he's parked in here. Look, I'm telling you the truth. Oh, I remember. Yeah. Earlier, I called 999. Yeah, about the same truck. About an hour ago, I saw a woman tied up in the back, and I think the same truck took my girlfriend. Look, please. He's parked in here. All I need you to do is just go out and have a look. That's all. I'm not going anywhere. Please, just look for a truck with a broken tyre light.
Goes out looking for a truck with a broken tyre light. More bad stuff happens. Now, here's the interesting thing about Hush. Is that on one level, it's a very, very nuts and bolts horror movie. It's a, you know, it's a guy sees something, thinks he sees something, not sure whether he's seen something, pursues
truck. Doesn't see something.
Well, mate, that's one of the questions that the movie is asking. I mean, I think, yes, he does, but, you know, but it's one of those kind of...
He might not have done.
It's all filmed in this very kind of intimate semi-handle. I think they're using one of those things... is it called a tilt and swing lens? I think it is. I may be wrong, but it's kind of like the lens that they use in Diving Bell and the Butterfly when only one particular bit of the frame is in focus at a certain time. And the very sort of naturalistic performances from the two leads. And then what happens is the guy's trying to follow this truck. He's trying to chase this truck. He doesn't know whether there's something in the back of the truck. Sinister stuff starts to happen around him, bad stuff. So on one level, it is basically a nuts and bolts, straightforward, you know, 88-minute B-movie slasher-type thriller thing in which somebody is abducted by a faceless person or a faceless truck. So there are hints of Jewel to some extent. There'll be hints of the Friday the 13th movies, not seeing the face of the killer, all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it's going to win prizes for originality. What's really interesting is that telling a story that I thought... I mean, there are elements in the story that are original. I haven't seen a film about somebody changing posters in motorway service stations before, and that had the smack of authenticity.
Why might that be?
No, I know, but it's interesting because that's something I didn't know anything about, and I learned something about it. But what's interesting is that for a movie that's low budget, stripped down, very unpretentious, very, very sort of straightforward in its kind of linear structure, there's only one sequence in it, one sequence that really doesn't work, which is a sequence involving a couple of security guards in which they kind of do some plot explanation and it just doesn't work because dramatically it doesn't work. With the exception...
Does it not work that bit?
It doesn't work dramatically, no. With the exception of that one sequence, I found it actually very tense and rather oddly chilling and exciting and put together with a dexterity and a skill that I really hadn't expected. I mean, it's a very confident exploitation movie. I'm not entirely sure that Marc Tondreau would like to think of it as that, but what he's done is made a real good stripped down sort of horror thriller. I think he's come into this from outside the genre, so I don't know that that's what he's consciously set out to do, but he has real directorial talent. He has a real directorial style. The performances are naturalistic enough, with the exception of that one scene which doesn't work. And I found myself gripping the edge of my seat and being genuinely quite tense and scared, and at the end of it being satisfied and thinking, you know what, that's a really good nuts and bolts, well put together, efficient little stripped down horror movie that did exactly what it said on the tin and I think shows great promise for things to come.
Gary in Leeds says, Simon is a devoted wit attainee of long standing, also frequenter of the hallowed Hyde Park Picture House, which is where we're going to be.
We're going to be?
Next Friday in our usual slot between 1 and 4. So we're doing the show in front of a live audience. Well, I'm not sure that's a wise idea. My excitement at the news of your impending visit could not be contained. My application for a single ticket was dispatched within seconds of the historic announcement being made. However, to my horror, I seem to have been overlooked. My desperation to gain admittance has now reached the point where I'm willing to act as a personal assistant to both of you. For the duration of your visit, my duties could include acting as your translator when conversing with Yorkshire folk, providing advice on how to house train one's ferrets. I could also bring along my extensive collections of Tottenham Hotspur, The Exorcist and Dodge Brothers memorabilia. Yours beseechingly, Gary. Well, let's talk to the woman who's in charge of the Hyde Park Picture House. She is Wendy Cook. She's on the line. Hello, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
Is it calm and quiet a week away from our show next week?
No, it's mental.
what have you got going on there this afternoon? If I come in now, what can I watch?
Nothing yet. Our first film's not till a bit later on today when we're showing the double bill of the Che film.
Oh, right,
very
so
good.
You've got part one,
and indeed part two.
And remember, it's Che, not Che.
Yes, exactly. She did say Che.
So why is it going mental then?
I've got lots of spring cleaning to do.
What, before we go? Oh, it's a bit like a royal visit.
It is.
Yeah, very much so.
We want everything freshly painted, exactly. And all the seats reupholstered.
Yes.
Lots of people have been telling us what a particularly gorgeous cinema that you've got there, Wendy. Just describe it. I know we'll meet you next week and we can do this in greater detail, but is it fairly historic and cosy?
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's built in 1914, so it's 95 this year, and it's Grade 2 listed, and it's the oldest surviving purpose-built cinema in Leeds. And it's just everything that, you know, when you close your eyes and think of an old cinema, that's us, basically.
And how much does it cost? How much do you charge?
It's £4.50 for students and £5.50 for adults, and then £6 up on the balcony.
That's £6 on the balcony. And what about if you were to show a 3D film? Would you charge extra for the glasses?
I'm afraid we can't show 3D films, so
there we go. That's what I want. There we are. See? Busy doing perfectly fine, can't show 3D films. That's it. And if other cinemas want to invest in it, then fine, but don't then come running to us for the money. Sorry, I'm on your side entirely with this.
If people don't have tickets, presumably there is absolutely no point in people like Gary, BSc in Ferritology from Leeds, for example, there's no point in him turning up and pleading to be let in, is there?
No, I mean, we'd have to give in to a lot of people because we've had quite a few people begging, I'm afraid. He's not the first to have asked if they could sneak in some capacity or another.
Right, so that's official from Wendy in charge of the Hyde Park Picture House. No beggars. All right. We're looking forward to coming to...
No 3D, no beggars.
And then what happens is, we're doing the show there, then I think we have a cup of water or something, tea and flapjack or whatever's available, and then we're going to show a movie, which is...
Am I allowed to announce it? I don't know if I...
It's on the ticket.
It is... Silent Running.
It's Silent Running.
Silent Running. I'm sorry, I wasn't sure if I was allowed to say it. It's Silent Running,
in 3D.
The greatest science fiction film. The film that 2001 could it have been had it been made by somebody who actually understood people.
Wendy, nice to talk to you. We'll see you next week.
Great.
Thank you. Wendy Cook, in charge of the Hyde Park Picture House, where this show comes from, next Friday. And then afterwards, as I think we should do, it's almost like it should be done every week. We do the show and then we show a movie.
Yeah, I think
it kind of
idea.
Makes sense.
Very good idea. Can I very quickly say something else, or have we got time or not?
You've got 2 minutes to do as many movies as you can.
Very quickly, there's a film coming out called Not Quite Hollywood, and there's a season of Ozploitation movies. I think it's on starting at the ICA in London. And very, very quickly, the thesis of the movie is, you know, that when the Australian cinema industry took off, and people talk about things like Picnic at Hanging Rock, and recently they talked about films like Australia, you know, arty Australian films.
The whole
thing is that what all of it wouldn't have existed had you not had this fantastic cheesy underbelly of Ozploitation movies, which are, you know, basically sex and violence and cars and more violence and more sex and more cars. And it's a documentary about the Ozploitation industry, which got a fantastic contribution from Barry Humphreys. And he's talking about the adventures of Barry McKenzie, and Barry McKenzie Holds His Own and Stalk and all those kind of movies, which are the things that made the money when people were all saying, oh, aren't these art movies wonderful? But it was the sleaze and the stodgy. It's got Quentin Tarantino in it. It's the first film I've seen with Quentin Tarantino in for a very long time that hasn't made me cross. Quentin Tarantino does the thing about talking about being a fanboy, loving all the Ozploitation films, and actually he does it rather well, and he's rather charming and kind of cute. And I just thought, the minute I saw it, I thought, oh no, not Quentin Tarantino, he's going to make me cross, but he didn't. And Barry Humphrey says this thing, which is very good. He's talking about what culture is, and he says the thing about culture is, Barry Humphrey also says, incidentally, you know, homophobia and racism can be fun. Bless him. But he says the thing about culture is basically mold. And in order for mold to grow, you have to have something that is decaying for it to grow on. And it's about the idea that if you're going to have high culture, you have to have low culture for the mold of culture to exist. And I think it's a beautifully expressed sentiment. Lesbian vampire killers is a kind of knowing postmodern version of the kind of movies that were coming out of, you know, the Ozploitation scene that eventually gave you things like Mad Max, of course, you know, which was absolutely huge, and it, basically people behaving badly on roads with guns.
And movie of the week, Marley and Me. Go on, say it.
No, Marley, I think I, you know, I think Bronson.
No, really?
Why?
No.
Okay, hush. No, how about Not Quite Hollywood? How about anything other than Marley and Me?
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.